Welcome to Radio Oldie and the Odd Couple with John Humphreys and Matthew Norman. Kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford, actual investors who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.
Hello, welcome to another installment of The Odd Couple, the podcast in which my friend John Humphreys and me, Matthew Norman, two of the most diametrically opposite characters known to humanity.
Speak for yourself.
Very kind. In which we chew over matters of, you know, hopefully of interest to the listening public. And today, John, and if I might say, you're looking even more upbeat and excited than usual.
You spotted it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you're always a ball of fun and merriment.
I'm just naturally happy.
You are naturally happy, and it's but today you're happy. You're lighting up the room with your beaming smile, and I suspect it's because the World Cup is being held this month.
You know so much about me.
Now tell me how excited you are about this football extravaganza.
I was.
So today we're going to talk about...
We're going to talk about, of course, everybody's talking about the World Cup, except those of us who think it is the possibly the most boring event. Maybe a royal engagement chases it a little, but the world, who cares?
Only the planet, really, except for you and about other people.
We're
going to talk about sport generally.
You probably do believe that, don't you? You probably do believe that. You are normal. You're not, Matthew, if I may say so.
Right.
You are weird.
So this is something we might agree on.
You are a man. Yeah. You're a man who will watch sport, if the conditions allow, all day.
Well, the conditions always allow.
My point exactly.
But I wouldn't say I'm obsessive. I would remind you that on my honeymoon, which is now, 35-odd years ago, we were in this lovely, elegant Shaker Inn, you know, in Massachusetts. And on the Sunday, I checked us out into this disgusting, filthy motel because they had cable and it was the last day of the Ryder Cup. And then I sent Rebecca...
Hang on a minute. You've lost me already. Golf. Golf, am I right?
Very good. International competition between American and European golf, biannual. And when it got coming to the climax, I sent my new wife of about 3 days out and over an 8-lane highway on foot to get bourbon and McDonald's. Now, why that woman left me some years later, I have no idea.
I was about to raise that very question.
But
what's that got to do with sport? You've lost me now.
Yes, well, it's an obtuse thing. But Ryder Cup is sport, very dramatic sport. I couldn't not watch it, even at the risk of ending my marriage after 3 days.
I see.
And I think one thing we might agree about.
So you're obsessed.
We might agree about here is that the loving sport is a kind of mental illness.
Oh, well, that's the end of this conversation. Thanks very much
for
joining me.
Well, it's nice seeing you, John. Because, I mean, it is something that I would say occupies 80% of my emotional life, at least.
Hang on. Define emotional life.
Well, my involvement in things.
You care about it.
Well, I mean, it's like a proxy for a normal life, yeah.
So you actually will get upset if one of the teams, that you don't like? This is what I don't get. I can understand. I was born in Cardiff. And
really?
I keep it quiet. But okay. We had a football team in Cardiff. I believe we still have a football team in Cardiff. And if people said Cardiff is winning a football game or going to win a football game, I'd have to show an interest. So to that extent.
But you were never taken to football as a kid?
Do you know what? I was once, because I know this sounds deeply bizarre, but my younger, lovely brother who died some years ago, whichever he happened to be working for at the time, he was the sports editor of BBC Wales.
Yeah.
And he made me go to a Cardiff football match.
Right.
Possibly the most boring hour and a half of my life, but then...
It's not genetic, this loathing of sport, then, obviously.
I don't think...
Not if your brother was a sports editor.
My
of Wales.
Father was utterly obsessed with athletics.
Right.
And that's because he was a runner when he was a young man.
Yeah.
I probably told you that he was blind when he was very young. Then he got some of his eyesight back. And the one thing he could do was run.
Right.
He ran very fast, 100 metres or 100 yards, as they used to call it in those days, and had his proudest possession. He won a silver medal at some contest, wherever it was, and he never, ever went anywhere without it.
Really?
It was always okay. In his pocket.
And so there's a bit of it.
A little bit of
it. But you bypass
you. But athletics, I can see it. I can understand. Because it's all over, in depending on what race, it might be all over in 10 seconds. Well, that's fine. I can handle 10 seconds of it.
Right.
Pretty broad-minded.
But yeah. A two-hour football match is... But, I know that you've watched a bit of football because...
Well,
I
did in your house. In your house.
And it was, I don't know if anyone remembers this, it was a 2016 European Championships.
I'll take
we were in
for
the
it.
Pub and I said, right, you're coming home with me because Wales are playing Belgium. And you said, I'm not coming, I hate football. I haven't seen a match since 1966, a certain match in the summer of 66. And you came back and you bleeding well loved it.
I did not. That is so untrue.
Right. If anyone wants to...
Oh, you're a journalist, aren't you?
Google the article in the Daily Mail that you wrote about it, in which you said it was...
In the Daily... You read the Daily Mail? Come.
Well, only because it was your piece. And Wales won against the favourites, I think. Tournament favourites in the quarterfinals won 3-1 in one.
Are you making this up?
I don't think so. It's all there in print. Anyway, so now we're on the verge of a World Cup. And... you will be disgusted by the kind of attention.
I tell you what, I'll be
month.
Appalled by is the amount of time the BBC spends telling us about it. I don't want to be told about the World Cup. Why do I have to be? Just like I don't want to be told about the latest royal engagement or whatever it happens to be. Why do I have to be told? That's the thing about sport. It's forced upon us.
And that's the tragedy is there's no such thing as an off button on a radio or or an app.
And where do you go? Yeah. Listen.
Radio 3, I guess.
The thing, there is that. I have seen a football match all the way through, admittedly quite a long time, I remember it very, very clearly because we, and I say we, although it was England, and I'm Welsh, as you may have spotted, we won against Germany.
Really? And now that's quite an obscure reference, isn't it?
That was...
I don't think I could put my finger on the game. When was it, John?
Difficult. It was in this country, and it was the World Cup.
Yeah.
And we...
We, yes, again.
As in this country, was playing against, for the final, for the championship...
Really?
Against Germany.
Or West Germany, maybe, as well.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. And that's the whole point, because if for us, who were, I mean, my father watched it. We had a rental television to watch it on. Everybody watched that game. And when we won, we all ran out into the street and had a huge party. Everybody did everywhere. Was
well, not so much in Glasgow.
We'd won the war. Not maybe not, I don't know.
No, or Belfast.
I said in this country. Glasgow's a different country. I believe that pretty much every people who never watched a game of football like me.
So now you put your finger on the power of sport to unite people.
But that had nothing to do with sport. It had everything to do with having won the war only a few years ago against the Germans. So we were fighting the war again. It was all about winning the war again.
Quite a lot about winning the World Cup for the first time.
No, I don't think where there was a World Cup or anything, but we beat the Germans.
Right.
We used slightly cruder language, which I will not use on this podcast because it would be wrong to do so. But we beat the Germans, and what a cause of celebration that was. Oh, wonderful.
So you think the context was irrelevant? It could have been a game of...
Ludo?
Could have been badminton, or it could have been a game of shove halfpenny. It was just beating, right?
Yeah.
And how come you never went after an analysis like that you weren't picked up to be a sort of sports person more? But with that insights like that, you could have, been a Des Lyon. You could have added a new string to your extensive
You're
bow.
Assuming, though, I don't still get offers, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
No, I just turned them down. I got better things to do, really, I suppose.
Right. So how much of the forthcoming... I don't know how many matches there are, but many hundreds of hours will you be watching?
I'm sorry, what are you talking about? Football again, are you?
And does it completely...
Can we talk about rugby instead?
No, we can't, because if it was the verge of the Rugby World Cup, yes.
Well, no, but the point about rugby, you see, is that we had a family connection. There was a family connection with rugby, because my sister came home one evening. She would have been 17 years old, so I would have been 12 or so. And she said to my grumpy father, I've got a new boyfriend. Mm. And he said, "Who?" with his usual interested and sympathetic approach to life. "Who?" And, no. He said, he didn't say who first. He said, "Where's he from?" And she said, "The Valleys." And he erupted. "The Valleys? So he's a nanny goat, huh?" That's how it was in those days, if mm-hmm. you were a sophisticated city dweller like we were. The nanny, the Valleys were for the nanny. And where? Which bit? She said, "Chapswell." And he said, "What's his name?" And she said, "Williams." And he was transformed. Mm-hmm. And I mean transformed. He completely stopped and thought and said, with a hushed voice, mm-hmm. "Not the Williams, but..."
Well, it's an unusual surname in Wales. I know, and nobody identified.
But weren't many Williams families in Wales, or indeed in the world. In fact, it was quite literally the most famous rugby family in the world at the time, because, of course, Blevin Williams, greatest rugby player of his time, mm-hmm. And half a dozen of them, the boys, were international players, and her new boyfriend, Elwin, was one of them.
I think the power of sport to break down prejudice. Again, we see its extraordinary range.
It has nothing to do with prejudice. I mean, that simply has to do
with... Well, he called him a nanny goat for reasons slightly lost for me.
But I imagine if she... I don't know if she said he just discovered the secret of life or something. I don't know. Perhaps he'd have had the same reaction. I doubt it. Probably not.
So you recognise the power, but you don't feel it.
I do recognise it, but I can see that. And in that particular case, it was quite extraordinary. And they were such lovely people. That's the other thing.
Well, rugby, they're gentlemen.
See, that's what's changed, hasn't it? Because they were, all of them, there were at one point six of them all playing for Wales. They were the most famous rugby family in the world, easily. Mm-hmm. And they were an extraordinary... They're also, most of them were war heroes. Mm-hmm. Blevin himself, who was the greatest centre, he was known as the Prince of Centres in the world. And Blevin himself was a war hero.
It didn't affect you. There's no passion. You don't feel it at all. There's nothing you've ever seen.
Except when I watched Roger Bannister with my father, because he was a runner, as I said, break the 4-minute mile. Right? I mean, that.
Well, that was up there in the top 58 iconic sporting moments in history. But
And I remember it.
Muhammad Ali didn't watch that fight with Foreman. 73.
I don't want to watch people bashing each other in the head. Really? No, I don't. Call me weird, but I don't. No.
Right.
No. I mean, I don't think. If when I become master of the universe, I will ban boxing. I mean,
right. No, I can see that.
Can you, really? Can you?
Yes, I mean, there's no excuse for boxing. Ah. It's just a great, wonderful thing to watch. It's a guilty pleasure, like fox hunting.
How can those two statements be true, Matthew? You don't agree with it? You would ban it, for obvious reasons, intelligent
people.
No,
I wouldn't myself, but I can see the argument. No, though people do things for pleasure which are not necessarily morally perfect.
Do you think they do it for pleasure, bashing each other in the head?
No, the pleasure is watching it.
Why?
I can't really explain that. It's quite a guttural, visceral thing, isn't it?
No.
It's an incredible...
I get absolutely no pleasure
watching
somebody.
That's the most big... One of the biggest events in global history, let alone sport, I would say.
Well, Muhammad Ali...
By far the most...
Was it Cassius Clay then?
No. Anyway, it was not Cassius Clay then, not for some years. He had been Cassius Clay when he was drafted and refused to fight when he...
Well, that was his name, wasn't it?
When he lost it was his slave name, yes. Hmm. Yes. And by then he was Muhammad Ali and... anyway... So, you don't watch boxing, you hate football, tennis, golf.
I have watched a few tennis matches. Right.
What I'm interested in, really, because this has shaped my life as much as anything since, you know, 5 or 6 years old, and a completely obsessive thing. I have a friend who's similar, and when his marriage broke down and there was a sort of list of complaints from his wife, his now ex-wife, and I think number 6 was... an obsessive addiction to watching live sport on television, right? Along with such other things as not stacking the washing machine properly and all of that. So
yes, I'd put it on the same level as that. Stacking the washing machine, not that I do, but if I did, I would put that on the same level as watching sport.
But me, I mean...
It's a bit more interesting.
But I find it physically impossible not to watch things.
Why?
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
I don't know. Why do you think?
I don't know. It's filling a need, clearly. Because people are much more emotionally involved in World Cups and other sporting events, particularly the World Cup.
Well, hang on. You're emotionally involved when you watch your child being born.
You just don't get it, do you? You've seen it. You've seen pictures of people behaving like maniacs, celebrating goals in open air, you know, big screen things. You know that it dominates the public discourse.
It dominates the public discourse.
And you know it does.
But hang on a minute. Hang on. We are, some of us are, you for instance, manipulated. There is a vast, vast amount of money in professional football in this country. A huge amount of money. Yeah. You wouldn't argue with that. And we are being manipulated.
How?
How? Open a newspaper this morning or any other morning. Go to the back page.
It was the same long before it was a huge money thing. Huge. It was the World Cup of 66 was a mammoth event.
This I have the edge of you because I am just a teeny weeny bit older than you. And yes, there was a lot of interest in whether Cardiff won the whatever the hell they were playing. But that was it. There wasn't hysteria. There wasn't massive, horrible, disgusting violence on the part of yobs who take over the city because their team is playing the local team, so they travel many miles getting drunker and drunker in order to have a fight in the streets. Oh, for God's
1930,
sake, it's pathetic.
First World Cup, 1930, right, in Uruguay.
Take your word for it.
The 1950 World Cup. In Brazil.
I was going to correct you.
Right, long before money came to dominate and you think everything changed and became corrupted and venal and cheap. And Brazil lost the final. They only needed to draw the match to win the World Cup. They lost the final. And that, there's a famous quote from a Brazilian historian, philosopher, which says every country has its absolute calamity, its Hiroshima. And for Brazil, it was losing the 1950 World Cup final.
So
in
he
Rio.
Put. Well, do you know what?
You
just made my case for me, haven't you? Here is a man you obviously respect, because you remember, he is putting losing a football match in the same category as the greatest crime in history.
Well, a national catastrophe. And it's
a national catastrophe.
I don't know if you've read a lot of books about the 1950 World Cup, but the effect on the Brazilian psyche was, you know, cataclysmic.
Well, that tells you all you need
to
know.
So that obsession...
I rest my case.
Yeah, but so that precedes the era of big money in football, and yet it was a matter of obsessive interest to one of the world's largest countries.
Don't skate away from it. On a scale of Hiroshima.
Yes, that's the quote.
Well,
it's quite hyperbolic, but he's saying it's a national tragedy
for
Brazil.
For the second time in this discussion, I'm lost for words.
Well, good. Then I'll speak for a bit while you try and recover your voice. So listen, that's 100-odd years ago. I'm sure it was the same in, you know, prehistory. The first writing about sport, I think, is in the Iliad. Is the games. I can't remember what they were. Ajax's games. And I'm sure there was cheating. I'm sure there was weeping. You know, sport, I mean, you have a blind spot to it, which I think is a good thing. You don't feel it. But you do acknowledge that sport is a massively powerful element in the lives of billions of people.
For sure.
And do you not feel a bit left out then at times like this?
On the contrary, I feel superior.
Right. Ah, that's interesting. No, you said it now. It's not going back in the box. I feel superior, Jay Humphries.
To those people who are obsessed with, in that regard, they may well, I mean, you, for instance, are a very good example. You're reasonably intelligent. I mean, you know, you've been known to write a good newspaper column and, you know, one or two other things. You are a very clever man.
No, I'm not boasting about it. It's
I didn't
it's
say
a
you
character.
Were. But
this
but
is a character flaw.
Oh, you accept that it's
Of course it is. What, to invest more emotional energy into sport than almost anything else, except your closest family? Yeah, of course it is.
So why do you allow it to happen?
You don't allow it to happen.
Of course you do.
You don't allow a psychosis. It's part of you.
Of course you do. If I tried to persuade you that Hitler was actually along the right lines, he just didn't approach it quite...
Where are we going now?
You'd struggle with that, wouldn't you? I mean, you would...
I think I might take some umbrage to be
as a human being. To hear you say, well, it's a bit weird having this passion. I don't know, is passion the right word? Obsession. This obsession with sport. Don't you think that's revealing of something?
Yeah, it's revealing of a sort of psychiatric disorder.
Oh. Well, there we are.
Yeah.
So that's the headline for this morning's
report. We agree about this.
Matthew Norman admits he's bonkers.
Well, me and billions of other people, yes. Yes.
Do you think, how many people are there like you, do you think?
I don't know. It'd be quite hard to quantify. Let's
stop 100 people in the street now, right now, and ask each of them. Are you obsessed with sport? What do you think the majority would say?
Probably not. But I'd say out of 8 billion, probably a billion people are... You know, live their lives through sport, their emotional lives.
Live their lives through sport.
They would invest most of their emotional energy into sport.
You see, we're back to this emotional energy. Mm. Do you get... I was emotionally... what's the right verb to use with emotion? I became... emotional. I have become emotional at various points of my life.
No rush.
The birth of my children, the death of my, of course. And we both know what that means, to lose somebody you love or to him, whatever. How does being emotionally obsessed with sport affect your life and the person that you are?
Well, on a practical level, it would take up a great deal of my life watching sport.
Obviously. Yeah, on a practical level, yeah.
On an emotional level, I haven't begun to recover yet. Admittedly, it's only 36 years, so I wouldn't want to rush it. But I haven't begun to recover yet from the defeat to Germany, reunified Germany, in the 1990 World Cup semi-final, which, as you remember, went to penalties. And ended with Stuart Pearce and then Chris Waddle missing for England.
We would
have won the World Cup. We would have beaten Argentina in the final, I'm sure.
And would you now?
And that was like a bereavement. I mean, it took me weeks to feel normal again.
Let's pursue that then, because if I talk to you about somebody you loved who died, when was this? What is this football game?
Only 36 years ago. So as recently as 1990.
Right.
So the wound's still fresh.
So 30 years ago. Yeah. If I talk to you about somebody who was very close, very dear to you, who died 30 years ago, and suggested it is slightly preposterous to put those two events on that same scale...
Well, we've already had Hiroshima and Brazil's defeat.
Well, that's true. If you can put Hiroshima...
See, I don't think you have any sense or flavour of how huge this is to people.
No, none at all. If you were a cretin, I could get that, you know. But you're not. You're an intelligent
man. Well, lots of people aren't.
It upsets me, mother. I worry for you, my dear fellow.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, I don't know.
You pay for me to have therapy. Extensive therapy.
Well, if I could sit in on the sessions, maybe.
Well, you should do. I think we'll come on to therapy in another day, in another podcast.
Possibly. Yeah.
But in the next month or so of this tournament, there will be a big spike in heart attacks, domestic violence, and various other crimes.
Yeah, of course there will be. So there always is. I mean,
yeah.
They will happen as a direct result. We haven't got a team. Wales hasn't got a team, has it?
Well, it's got a team. It's not going to America or Mexico or Canada.
That's what I mean.
It will be as a direct result. Certainly the heart attacks will.
I don't think I believe that.
Well, Google it. And also...
Which particular site?
Just Google, the spike in A, heart attacks, and B...
And how did they prove it?
How do you prove anything? Just data.
Oh, Matthew, that's
beneath you. They record the night of an England defeat at A&E's, there will be a large spike in people having cardiac events, always. Because that's the level of stress and the stress hormones that goes with watching England go out.
I don't think I believe that.
Well, Google it, because it's just recorded fact. And the fact that you don't believe it doesn't mean it's not. It's just a fact.
Mm.
Why would it not cause a coronary event, massive stress coursing through the body? It just does.
So what do you make, then, of people? Let's assume that you're right and that actually it does happen,
yeah,
as you describe. What do you make of the sort of person who has a heart attack because he's simply failed to kick a ball into a net at a particular point in a particular game? What do you make of that reaction?
Well, it's just a physiological reaction to immense stress.
But do you not think?
I mean, it's
for God's sake, man. I mean,
I think you're confusing this with something people have a lot of control over.
Oh, I see. So you lose complete control when somebody's kicking a ball into a net.
Yeah, not complete control.
I mean, now that is,
but a lot of control over your body. Yes,
right. So you'd lose control at the sight of a child dying of hunger or something. But somebody failing to kick a ball into a net, really? You'd lose control?
Well, you don't have a lot of control over the amount of stress hormones coursing through your veins, do you?
Yes. And yes.
Well, you can meditate.
You have a great deal of
control
over it. That's why we don't go around killing each other. And
no, but it's a
stealing when we're
hungry. It's a simple physiological reaction to something you're
watching. It's a bizarre reaction. It's weird.
Yeah, to you it's weird.
Yeah, but profoundly. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find some common ground here, but it's a struggle because it's a complete blind spot, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I've spent most of my life, I've written books, you know.
Oh, I have.
I
nearly read one. All right, I nearly opened one of them.
You know, you would have put you in a coma very quickly. So I have my life has been devoted to this. And if you think of the time and effort that's been wasted, it's a sort of tragedy.
So you don't... All right, divide your life into those hours when you are either engaged in, that's to say, watching, because you don't play any sport, do you, as such?
Not in reality.
Right, okay. So if you were to divide your life into those hours spent involved in watching sport, or thinking about sport, or talking about sport, or whatever, as opposed to playing with sport, and all the other stuff you do in your life, do you not look at that division of time and say, what a bloody waste?
On one level, yes, but on the other level, it would be a kind of insane arrogance to think that my time would be usefully spent somewhere else.
You know that's silly.
Because I have nothing to offer.
You could volunteer to help out at the old folks' home or something.
Yeah,
you could do both. You could do both.
Yeah.
But if you're spending as much of your time as you... I mean, I have been there on one of the days when you've done virtually nothing but watch sport. I mean, it's going to happen now soon, isn't it? I mean...
It's a tough one because there are matches kicking off at 3 in the morning as well as, you know, 4 in the afternoon, 7. So it's kind of round the clock. If I had any self-respect, I would have reconfigured my body clock for this by staying up to make sure I was awake and sharp at 3 in the morning for the next month or few weeks.
Are you being serious?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's in North America, so depending on how far west it is.
But you know you have two teams, as I understand it. 11 men in each team. I think I got that fairly clearly. You would literally lose sleep because one of them...
Yeah,
I hasten to add, this could be...
No, I mean, I wouldn't get up at 3 in the morning to watch Cape Verde play Curaçao.
Right.
But if it was Brazil and Morocco at that time, I would, of course. It would be a moral obligation.
A moral obligation.
Yeah.
You're a master of...
Listen, I don't have many World Cups left.
A moral
obligation. I've always counted my life in World Cups. So I'm now about 17.
Now you're just...
I may only have two or three. Maybe have what? This might be my last at my age. I cannot. It would be an act of moral turbitude to miss any football that could easily be watched.
I thought we were being quite serious in this conversation, but now I'm giving up. Come on, you're not being... What do you mean? Look, I can see just about, although I find it profoundly boring... partly I would accept because I don't understand it, but nonetheless I can see that you would admire somebody who was able to kick a ball from one person to another person who's about half a bloody mile away and all that. Brilliant. And or kick the ball into the top right-hand corner of the net or something like that. I can see the there is skill involved. Of course there's skill involved. My brother-in-law, Blevin, was a genius with a rugby ball.
About the Williams family, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I can see that. But the idea of getting emotionally upset... Mm. Or so involved that you would literally lose sleep over it, baffles me.
Yeah. I've got a friend who has a friend in Stoke who did literally, with the Ashes series that was played, you know, in the winter in Australia, literally spent weeks changing the time he went to bed and got up so that he could be up all night to watch it.
And your reaction to that?
Hats off to him. He should be given a knighthood. That's how men should behave, and women should behave.
I see.
Yeah, completely. I mean, that's devotion.
I'm not often lost for words.
If the England team had shown that devotion to their cricket that he showed to watching it, they might have won the Ashes. Unfortunately, he was much more committed than they
And would winning the Ashes have a lasting effect on you?
Because I know it, because in 2005, as you well remember, England, the greatest test cricket series of all time, just staggering. Every ball of every session was electrifying after the first test. And we beat Australia by narrowest of margins. And that the memory of that still nourishes my soul.
Are you being serious?
Yeah, of course I am. Yeah.
Good Lord.
When Tottenham won the FA, there are two happiest moments of my life, and it's very hard to pick a winner, were the birth of my son, 29 and a bit years ago, and Ricardo...
Stop. You're not making...
And Ricardo Villa...
...between a football match and the birth of your
Ricardo,
son. I refuse to accept it. This is an intelligent conversation.
Ricardo Villa scoring the winning goal, which most normal people would remember with fondness, except Arsenal fans, in the FA Cup final replay of 1981, when he sighed through the Manchester City defence and dribbled his way and slid the ball under Joe Corrigan's body. And I don't know which of those two moments was a more kind of elemental burst of sheer, pure ecstasy.
Does it ever occur to you what you might have been able to do if you took all of this time and effort and intellectual energy and used it?
If I was a bigger, more intelligent, more useful person, I might have achieved. I might have, but I'm not. I'm not Mozart. I'm not Leonardo da Vinci. I'm not Francis Crick or Marie Curie. Mm. So my life is a thing of minimal value, even to me, and it might as well be spent watching sport.
Right. So we can close the conversation then on something we agree on. It is of minimal. Sport.
My life is of minimal.
Yes, quite sport. So. But because you're obsessed with sport. Because
yes.
It has enriched
and elevated my life like little else, sport, and given it not meaning exactly.
All right, what's the second most important thing?
It's not the most important thing, it's the second most important thing.
All right, what's the first most important?
As with most people, the people I love.
The people you love?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you had to choose... I'm not going to go there.
I did once. We hadn't been married that long, maybe 10 years. We had a debate about what would happen if she died and the funeral, for some reason, was set on the day of an FA Cup final in which Tottenham were playing. And I thought about it and I said, look, you won't take umbrage. She said, of course not. I said, look, a funeral is a movable feast. I can easily switch the date of your funeral. I cannot move the date of the FA Cup final. On that basis, I'm afraid the FA Cup final would have to take priority.
I can't follow that.
Okay.
It's not often I say that, but I can't.
As I said, why that woman left me remains one of the great unanswered mysteries of my life and maybe human existence. She was like you, Rebecca. And my son Louis.
She is a highly intelligent person.
She is, and so is my boy. And they no sport of any interest.
How did she put up with you for so long?
I don't know. She's a very sweet, tolerant. But the only time they ever appeared, and it was like they had this sense of vultures, literally, the carrion crow, they would appear, and I don't know how they knew instinctively that England were about to lose in a penalty shootout, and they would suddenly appear and sit there and watch my grief and misery as we went out. So, you know, I'm used to this. And Rebecca has no interest. She'll watch a bit of tennis. But they don't have your kind of visceral loathing of it. That's the difference. And your condescension and sneering about people like me. They're more...
Might the world... Final thought, then. Might the world, given the problems that sport produces, professional sport, let's emphasize, by the way, because we haven't done this so far, we have been talking about professional sport. I got no problem at all with kids kicking a ball around at school. Absolutely fine. My son...
Oh, that's nice of you. It's gracious. Yeah, you're not going to ban it in school,
not going to ban sport. Blimey. Professional sport. Let's be perfectly clear about that. We are talking about that.
Yeah. I think that was implicit, but do go on.
No, well, I just wanted to be clear.
Yes, it was the amateur bout between Ali and Foreman and
quite
so.
There
Kinshasa.
Is a difference between that and kids playing in the playground. Yeah, yeah. Would the world be a better place without it?
No. Without sport?
Without a professional
sport. Oh, God, sport. I can't imagine it.
No, you can't. Of course you can't.
Would it be? Why would it be better?
Why am I asking you? Because, of course...
Why would it be better than something that gives joy and excitement to billions of people? You are the Thomas Cromwell, aren't you, of sport? You'd ban it in the way that they, you know, that you're a Puritan. You'd ban Christmas if you could. You're the Grinch, aren't you?
That is just so foolish.
You hate compare. But I understand why people hate Christmas. But would you actually ban? Would you ban professional sport? If you were lifetime dictator of the planet,
yeah,
you would ban it.
I would. Yeah. I wouldn't ban sport. Absolutely not.
Amateur sports, fine. Playgrounds.
Amateur sport, absolutely fine. And it doesn't just have to be playground. I mean, I sit there, grown-ups, they're adults. I live opposite a tennis court. I see people playing tennis all the time. It upsets you enormously because they don't play very well, most of them.
Oh, they come out
and
this
it
time
upsets
of year. They
you.
See
you actually become, you see, this is the proof of it. You are,
have them.
Can we accept that?
I wouldn't shoot them, but I'd have them in prison for short, sharp bursts.
I think you probably would, wouldn't you?
I hate bad tennis.
So that's it. Do you know
what? Or you put up big black tape right around it so that no one has to see it. Because you've just seen, you know, Federer playing Nadal, and then you go out and see these idiots who can't get the ball over the net.
You've made my case.
It's a crime against, to borrow from my old friend John McEnroe, it's a disgrace to humanity.
Why shouldn't I just rest my case there? Because that is... Well, that is about as crass as it gets.
They're the pits of the world.
Yeah.
Did I ever tell you, I met John McEnroe once.
Yeah.
By chance.
I met people who...
And I managed to goad him into a tantrum about because he was banging on about people choking at Wimbledon, Tim Hemman and so on. And eventually I'd had an extra vat of wine and I said, well, you're going on about these people choking. What about the 1984 French Open final? What are you trying to say? I said, well, if I recall it correctly, you led Ivan Lendl by two sets in a break and you lost the match. What is your point? I said, well, it's not a difficult or obscure point, John. I'm just saying, did you choke? I mean, was it? Anyway, it didn't go well. And as he left about 10 minutes later, I thought, in an insanely misjudged last-ditch attempt at bridge building, I said, it was the night before a Wimbledon women's final between the Williams sisters, not your family in Bledin or Blaith or Gough, but it was a Williams, Serena and Venus from Compton, straight out of Compton in Los Angeles. And I said, John, I said, which of the Williams girls do you think is going to win tomorrow? He said, you obviously know much more about tennis than I do. Why don't you ask yourself? Which was rather brilliant put down, I thought.
I'll settle for that.
Will you?
Yeah. Why don't you ask yourself about your obsession?
Well, obviously, I think that could be the theme of this, is you telling me ask yourself, because I've got no bleeding interest whatsoever. Well, listen, John, before we go, I just want to say one thing before we say farewell.
Oh, God.
The last time we were here, we were talking about restaurants, and a slightly diametrically opposed take on that. And since I mentioned a restaurant called Otto's in Gray's Inn Road in central London, which is the kind of place that no one would be used to, extraordinarily interesting and eccentric and expensive. And I saw the owner at my Turkish bars the other day, and I said, I just mentioned your wonderful restaurant. And he said,
you wanted a free meal.
To my friend John Humphreys, and a friend in very large quotes, we've been discussing restaurants. And he said, why don't you bring him along? So with your permission, I would very much like, he will treat us to lunch at his restaurant. I think it would be an eye-opening experience. Would you be willing to come to that at some point?
Depends whether I get 50% of the fee that you're obviously getting for publicising.
You can have 50% of my fee.
I'm so cynical.
Excellent. No. It'll be fun. All right. Well, listen, can I just say I hope you enjoy the next however many weeks of World Cup football.
I'm planning for it.
And I hope you'll come round and watch a game, not necessarily at 3 in the morning.
We could combine the two. We could watch a game while we're eating at Otto's.
Brilliant idea.
Yeah.
It's not the kind of restaurant that puts up a jumbotron, but I'm sure for you, national treasure that you are,
he'll do it.
He will bend over backwards.
I hugely look forward to it.
And here's to England ending the 60 years of hurt in a few weeks and raising the Jules Rimet Trophy.
Yeah. Believe it or not, Matthew, I have in my house, as we speak, two books on sport written by you.
Well, I'm sure, and I'm sure that there's barely a night goes by without you dipping in, if only briefly. One of them was a list. It was a bunch of the things that have annoyed me most in sport. Starting,
must have been a very
Adolf
long
Hitler's
book.
In there at number 100. Adolf Hitler in the 30s came upon some expats playing cricket in Bavaria, and got interested and wanted to. I think it was that wonderful spy writer, in the Times, Ben McIntyre, discovered this, and he wanted to change the rules. His only complaint about cricket, it was too soft. He thought the balls were too soft, so he pretty much wanted them to use cannonballs, right? So Hitler's in there, and I think number one was, I can't remember. I think the England football team is number two or three. Anyway, it's all the things that have irritated me most in sport. The other one was even more eccentric. Was a book about, you remember Leicester City's miraculous winning of the Premier League?
Obvious, I do.
5,000 to 1 on the unlikeliest thing that's ever happened in probably global sport.
Well, Leicester City won a football match.
They won the title.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Anyway, and there's a whole story. It was bizarre. They found Richard III's remains in the car park when Leicester City were about to be relegated.
While they were winning the title?
No, the season before. They're about to be relegated. From the moment the remains were discovered, Leicester City went on a staggering run, the likes of which, sound like Donald Trump, the world has never seen. And they stayed up, and the next season, miraculously and unimaginably, they won it. And the name of Leicester City's stadium, owned by a Thai family, duty-free mogul, and the name of the book is King Power. So the book was written from the viewpoint, in the voice of Richard III, describing Leicester City's, which I know you, I don't know why I'm telling you, because you got the book, you seldom go a day without refreshing yourself. The first book, I think if you did ever read it at gunpoint, while strapped to some sort of gurney in the style of Hannibal Lecter, is because sport is not about sport. It's about every single thing.
It's about ego.
Every single
ego and wealth.
So in the last few days, we've had a story about the England cricket captain, some nightclub ruckus, and it brings in questions of duty and responsibility. We've had a Somali referee banned from the United States because he's from Somalia, with a perfectly valid visa, which tells us a little something that we already knew about Donald Trump's America. So every single major sporting event is about a great deal more than the pure sport.
Right, so it's not the sport that matters. It's
a mixture, yeah.
Yeah. Settle for that. So my contempt for professional... professional.
Can I just clarify this?
Because it's a
very difficult concept. You're not talking about 7-year-olds playing at school.
I am positively not talking
about
that. My youngest son had a huge amount of pleasure from playing rugby.
Yes. Well, he had the build.
And my sister was married into the greatest rugby family in the world.
What was their name? Was it Jones? Was it Everett? No, Williams.
You got it. Well
Williams
done.
Family. Okay.
Well done.
And now, I'm thinking back now to your old life on the radio.
Oh, yes.
Maybe I was imagining it, but when it was 8:27 a.m. and you were introducing Gary Richardson, it always struck me that you did it with the same relish as you introduced Thought for the Day. Is that unfair of me?
I do remember. I remember a sports slot. I think it was Gary, as it happens, that never appeared. And I became, and I'm very, very proud of this, I became the first presenter, I believe, in the history of the Today program to override the sports slot, because I was, admittedly, it was a trivial matter. I was interviewing the Prime Minister, or the former Prime Minister.
And you refused to yield.
On the day after the Chilcot inquiry, which ripped him apart over his invasion, his illegal invasion of Iraq. And I carried on. I didn't stop when it got to half past, and you had to stop at half past for the sport. I just kept going, and I didn't finish. It was the longest interview we've ever done on the Today programme. I didn't finish until about 7 or 8
in
minutes.
The evening.
And I just kept going. I'm so proud of that.
Well, you, sir, are a true enemy of sport. And on that note, I'm going to bid you farewell. And we'll be back in a while talking about something else on which, no doubt, we thoroughly agree.
I doubt that.
Look after yourself, Walter.
And you.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.